Okay, hello everybody. We are picking up in the middle of Justice where we left off last time. I want to finish that, then devote some time to a variety of written questions. And up until the end of the first hour, if there's any remaining time, I'll again ask for live questions as I did last time. So if you want to prepare a live question, there may be time. And then the last half hour, I'm going to start on objectivity. We had a four-point agenda to reach justice, and we covered two things, the first 2 points last time. We induced the need to evaluate things as such and act accordingly. And then the need to evaluate men insofar as we dealt with them and act accordingly. And we contrasted this latter, the need to evaluate men, with the policy, in essence, of refraining from evaluation, of moral agnosticism, or judge not that ye be not judged. Now, on the point of judging people, you realize that we have induced the necessity to judge people at a point where we do not yet know how to judge people in any systematic or principled way. Morally, we're on the level that, you know, doing your homework is good and committing murder is bad. I say morally, we're on a very elementary level here. We're just starting to grow toward what will become moral principles later in our development. And these early inductions are the way we're going to get to morality. So we have no idea yet what traits are morally fundamental, what we should judge, what's unimportant. We learn that in good time. But we judge on the basis of what the common sense evaluations that I indicated last time. And now point three, the issue of acting accordingly. How do we come to the conclusion that an action component is crucial, along with judgment? And how far do we get in this early process in defining what that action would be? In other words, assuming that we've concluded in some terms the importance of judging, how do we get to the conclusion that we must act on our judgments, and specifically in the form of offering a reward or punishment? Here again, we have preliminary guidance from our behavior toward the non-human world. In grasping the initial generalization that evaluation of things must precede and guide action because of the consequences of good or bad things on us, it's obvious that a certain kind of action has to follow our judgment in regard to inanimate things. And what kind? That's part of the very first induction, as we said. You don't simply discover that the tomato is poisoned and therefore it's important to judge tomatoes. Inherent in that is it's poison and stay away from it. Don't swallow it. So inherent in discovering that some things, like that tomato or shark-filled lake, lead to bad consequences, we come to the conclusion they should be avoided or we're going to get hurt. Whereas others, like wholesome food or appropriate recreational facilities, lead to positive results and should be embraced. So that, as applied to things, acting accordingly is easily grasped by induction. If we identify a thing as good, we should deal with it, make use of it, produce it, promote it, in other words, depending on the particular case, enjoy and or maximize the value to us that the thing represents. Not only eat the good tomato, but other things equal, work to grow good tomatoes, to fertilize so that we can have more, to continuously improve on nature in the sense of maximizing the good in terms of quality and quantity, other things being equal. And by the same token, we do the opposite in regard to what we call bad, or what we judge to be bad. We shun it, if we can, or do what we can to prevent or minimize it, such as uprooting weeds, eradicating plagues, taking safety precautions to avoid accidents, and so on. Now, in broad terms, the same policy, the same principle would obviously apply to the kind of action appropriate to our judgments of human beings. If good men are those that promote our values, making our days better, happier, then, so far as it's within our power, we want to deal with such men, encourage them, promote them, maximize the value we gain from the good. Now, that, of course, does not mean growing more babies, so there's not an exact parallel to the tomato case. It means establishing, as far as we can, a climate that will encourage the power and consequences of the good. And similarly, in the opposite direction, for the bad, we want, at minimum, to shun the bad among people, and as far as we can, to defang it, deter it, prevent it, or minimize its impact on our lives. If good men are to our interest, our egoistic interest, then it is to our interest, assuming a reasonable time and cost, to promote good men. And by the same reason, it's to our selfish interest to stop or deter bad men. Now, we have to figure out how you apply this principle, how you encourage the good and deter or minimize the bad among people. How are we going to figure out what that consists of specifically? Should we try to deduce from the nature of man what things would encourage or deter him? No. You cannot deduce from man, as a, whatever your definition is, a rational being, what would encourage or deter except in a floating, empty way. You have to go back to reality and observe what kinds of behavior toward good men and toward bad men have what sort of results. You accumulate many cases across a diverse range, and then you abstract and induce the principle that the pattern indicates. And it's probably most obvious to start with cases close to home and then move to the scale of politics and history. So a boy does his chores, works hard, does his homework, and as a result, he gets good grades, he's praised by his parents, he's taken to the movies. In other words, we observe that his good actions are greeted by good things as a response from others. And if you heard about or watched such a situation, it would be obvious that, other things being equal, he will develop well and flourish in this kind of situation. By contrast, what will happen to a child with the same good qualities who is put into a progressive or social-minded school? A child who is told that the right answers are determined by a vote, that all students are equal, that we can't have grades because we don't want to hurt anybody's feelings, and that the dumbest, laziest student in the class gets equal voice in deciding the truth. And suppose he's also told that he should keep quiet precisely because he thinks that he knows it all and he's got to learn humility and the superiority of the group to the individual. And he goes home and his parents tell him that it's bad to act better than the other children. He won't be popular. So he gets the message of disapproval for his hard work, and they tell him, in effect, relax, Johnny. Why don't you go out and play with the kids and be human? You're too tense. Don't be so perfect, etc. Now, this is a case of a good child with good actions visited by bad consequences for it on the part of others. And it's obvious that if the first policy we mentioned encourages or promotes the good, insofar as others have any say in that question, The second policy would discourage, demotivate, and even crush the child, redirect them to becoming lazy and weak. Now, obviously, there's free will. Other people are not decisive, but we're talking about what are the effects of the policies insofar as external factors have an effect. So we have a case of good being greeted with good and good being greeted with bad. Or, in other words, good being given a value, a reward, versus good being given a disvalue, a negative, something akin to a punishment. Now, what about this case? Let's take the same situation, but as follows. This time, we're going to project the lazy, ignorant student going to a proper school and being criticized by the teachers, forced to stay after school to make up work, disdained by his fellow students and his parents. They tell him, no TV this week, and so on and so on. In other words, bad actions, bad consequences on him as a result, versus the lazy student going to the progressive environment and finding that his very ignorance and irresponsibility leads to reward, special treatment, acceptance by the group, etc. That would be bad actions being visited by good consequences. And here again, obviously, the first would tend to discourage and deter his evil or his badness, the second to encourage and promote the bad. So this is the pattern of what we are looking for. And the task of inducing here is to take cases in all different fields of the good being greeted with good versus the good being greeted by bad, and the bad being greeted by good versus the bad being greeted by bad. So there's actually four different cases here. And you have to concretize all of them in sufficient quantity and across a broad enough range until it's obvious that two of these four cases accomplish exactly what you're after, which is to support and maximize the good. And two of these are the reverse. So we have to concretize the good results of rewarding the good and punishing the bad, and the bad results of punishing the good and rewarding the bad. And that will give you the full contrast between justice and injustice in regard to action, each of which comes in two forms. Now, for induction here, Atlas Shrugged is a treasure house because justice is one of the central themes and the injustice of the altruist ethics. I have to assume that your knowledge of objectivism or your ability to think on your own after this class will enable you to come up with heaps of examples, but wherever you look, you should be able to have that flood that we're always looking for. You just, friends, look at the medical situation. Think of doctors in the free market and the kind of life and monetary rewards and acclaim they get. The good doctors versus the bad ones who are on the margins and suffer all the negative consequences, probably ending up in an army base. As against under the HMO system, where the good doctors are continuously penalized and attacked for their judgment, and the bureaucratic mentality that wants not to think and not to cause trouble is continuously rewarded and encouraged. Now, that's just one political example. And I mean, the number of examples, you could jump to Adolf Hitler. His action, for instance, is preaching mass death and orchestrating street killings in the 20s. And what he received in response was vehement praise from the German intellectuals, emotional support and enthusiasm, a huge vote from the still free country, big contributions from a lot of businessmen, etc. Here is an arch case of the bad being greeted by the good. And you saw what that led to. I'm sorry. Okay. And imagine the same man, Adolf Hitler, in 18th century America, and what the response would be to him. There would be the perfect example of the bad being greeted by the bad. Or to go from the sublime to the ridiculous, you go to a bad cleaner, a launderer, you know, who stains your shirt, and you say, I'm not going to deal with you any further. I want your money back. You tell your friends. You visit a lot of negatives, a lot of bad things, and in response to his bad actions, as against the man who does a great job, you thank him, you pay his fees, you tell your friends, etc. Now you see that there, you can project countless cases, and you should be able to, whatever story you look at, or page of history, or newspaper, it should leap out at you on all levels, personal, social, historical, and in all forms of the good or the bad, small or large, that the appropriate action to take to carry out your judgment in a way that will foster your selfish values is to reward the good and punish the bad, as against the opposite policy, which is reward the bad and punish the good. And when you see that in enough cases, you induce, and that is the principle, that the appropriate action following your evaluation is to visit good or the a reward on of some reasonable kind on the good action or the good person, and vice versa for the bad. So let's summarize the whole progression as far as human beings are concerned so far by saying, human beings' actions and characters have a consequence, an effect on you. Therefore, it's important to judge them, because it makes a difference to you that some people are good and some are not. You have to know it. That's the first component. And a different kind of consequence. Your action in response to people has consequences that makes a difference to your values. And therefore, it's important for you to act on your judgment appropriately. So, summation, if you deal with people and you want to achieve your goals and values, it's important to judge each one first and then act accordingly. Now that brings us, and we know what that is, and that brings us now to the last point. Now, what I've said so far would be applicable to rearing a toddler or training an animal. Namely, in some terms, you judge what the entity does as good or bad, desirable or undesirable, in favor of your values or against, and then you act accordingly, punishing or at least inflicting a negative of some kind, as for instance in the case of a toddler, time out when he behaves a certain way. In your attempt to extinguish the bad behavior, and you reward or reinforce the action that you want to encourage and habituate. So there is definitely an analog in regard to non-rational beings of what we have said so far, that you evaluate and act accordingly, at least conscious non-rational beings, and you act accordingly via positives or negatives. But this is not yet justice, even though it lives up to what we've been saying in essence. You can say, well, I'm punishing my animal by yelling at him or locking him in a room or whatever, but you don't do this with the idea he has it coming to him, given what he has done. He picked this course, and now he's getting his proper desserts. In other words, you do not believe in regard to a toddler or an animal that he has earned or deserves a certain punishment, that morality dictates it. To an animal, we behave as the behaviorist behaves to people. You don't, if you're rational, you don't experience anger, nor moral condemnation, nor moral admiration. And yet these are essential even to a rudimentary concept of justice if you're contrasting it to animal training. And what, therefore, is the crucial ingredient that we have to bring in to convert what we've been saying into the minimal concept of justice? You have to bring in or integrate what we have said so far with the fact of free will, which we've already covered in a previous, or at least we said we wouldn't cover it, but we've mentioned it. When you combine volition with the judgment of a man, then you see that the goodness or badness of the person's behavior is chosen. It's a product of his own decision. It's self-made. Now, you may not grasp the term at an early stage, but what you grasp is in substance the idea of responsibility. This person is responsible for his behavior. It's simply in the sense of if he is good in a given respect, he chose to be or to act that way. And if he's bad, ditto, as against animals where we don't believe that, where we believe that they're merely reacting to stimuli without choice. Now, if you believe that your dog or cat has free will, that's okay. You can apply an elementary concept of justice to them. But the point, you can just think of a rat of Skinner or a newborn baby. Your grasp that a person is responsible carries with it automatically, I believe, an entirely different pattern of emotional response to him. For instance, if a machine works well or a rat runs the maze efficiently, you may feel a positive response, some sort of satisfaction or equivalent of good. Yes, that's fine. But you do not feel anything in the same category as your response to a positive choice by a human being. And this is most obvious on the more extreme cases. You don't feel admiration or reverence or uplift or hero worship in regard to a machine or a rat. All of those feelings presuppose that you're responding to someone who embodies certain values as an issue of his choice. And the same is true with the negative. If you see a broken machine or a lethargic rat, you may be disappointed or react in various negative ways, but if you are at all reasonable, you don't feel anger, condemnation, you don't axe the machine or whip the rat, you don't feel the affront of wickedness in your presence. All these negatives too imply the volitional choice of the bad on the part of the entity you're judging. So you have to realize, and you do this by tying in the fact of volition, that man is a moral being, and therefore you offer him a moral response. Now, I didn't use the word moral in this induction, because I think that a whole separate series of inductions is necessary to reach the concept of morality and why man needs it. We'd have to have a whole bunch of virtues and a whole bunch of values before we can abstract the very concept of a code of virtues and values accepted by choice and why we need. So moral as a term, I think, comes later. But nevertheless, that is in substance what I'm trying to get at without using the term, and that's what a child has to implicitly grasp once he grasps free will. The idea that we as adults would say this is a moral choice as against simply a reaction. And children obviously grasp the difference at a certain point. Now, early, they don't. They say wicked dog and a wicked mummy or whatever, and they make no distinction, but very early, they do. Now, just as the volitional nature of men conditions all of your responses to them. It also applies and helps to define what is meant by a just response. It applies both to the evaluating and the acting side of justice. When you evaluate a human being, you're evaluating him as a being who could have behaved differently. And when you reward or punish him, you are acting toward him on the premise that he asked for it. His actions are self-made. So your response to his actions is, in effect, self-made by him. He brought it on himself by his own choice. And in that sense, he has it coming to him, or in the term which you're building up to, he deserves it. Now, the idea of dessert, one S, with two S's, it's fattening. The idea of dessert is the idea of an appropriate response, whether evaluation or action, reward or punishment, an appropriate response to a volitional being. That's inherent and indispensable to the idea of dessert. Now, the Oxford English Dictionary defines deserve, in essence, as to become worthy of reward or punishment according to one's good or bad character or conduct. Well, what makes you worthy of reward or punishment is what you have done combined with the fact that you chose it. That, I think, is the essence of deserve. And that's what you have to grasp to reach even a rudimentary version of the concept of justice. The action in justice is specifically recompensing a responsible agent because of what he has chosen to do, rather than simply because of the consequences that will redound on you or others in the future. Now, I have to make a quick clarification here for those of you who have had the misfortune to study philosophy. I mean, I'm saying that somewhat ironically, but you get into a lot of false alternatives when you study philosophy, and one of them is very relevant here. Philosophers have an absurd debate going as to whether justice is, as they put it, future-looking or past-looking. Now, future-looking is like the utilitarians, and they say justice is entirely a matter of the consequences. You punish or reward in order to ensure certain consequences for the future. Now, obviously, I've already said that, so I agree with that. It's the point that men are not stars. If there were no consequences of judging and acting a certain way, then there would be no point in the whole issue of justice. So do I say then, well, justice is, quote, future-looking? No. Now that brings, what do you mean by past-looking? The Kantian types say, you punish or praise not because of the results you want in the future, but because of what's already been done in the past. Namely, this man chose a certain course, and therefore, no matter what the results, he deserves appropriate recompense. Now, the true element in this is that desert does depend on what the man did and on his having chosen it. So then what's the resolution? Well, obviously, this is a bizarre false alternative. It's one of the falsest alternatives I ever heard of, to say you got to choose as to whether justice has its roots in the past or in the future. The situation is a man has chosen a certain course of behavior. And therefore, he has chosen to inflict its results on others, and therefore, he has chosen a certain response by others to him. This is a single unity. And that is the basis for justice and desert. Neither alone would be sufficient. If you could say, he chose it, but it has no consequences, then it, as I've explained, it would be irrelevant to judge it. But if you say, It has consequences, but he had no choice. It's back to the animal or the machine level. But the fact is, in the human case, neither can exist without the other. and it's a complete nonsensical exercise to try to decide which counts. If you choose to be evil, you will necessarily in the long run harm people. You will have consequences. And if you harm people, leaving aside sheer accident, which is outside of morality, it's because you chose to be or act in a certain way. And therefore, it's a complete false alternative. So if you understand this, volition will add the concept of desert to our earlier account of justice without contradicting our stress on the consequences of reward and punishment and the fact that they are crucial. So, we finally reach an early concept of justice, which I would summarize like this. Now, a kid that gets this is pretty good, but this is the bare minimum that I can see. Evaluating a volitional being for what he has chosen, good or bad, and then giving him what he deserves in terms of reward or punishment. Evaluating a volitional being for what he has chosen, good or bad, and then giving him what he deserves in terms of reward or punishment. Now that, to me, is a perfectly nice preliminary start on the concept of justice. There's obviously still an awful lot of aspects of justice which are crucial to it, which I haven't touched on. I wrote a whole long section in OPAR of the bare minimum necessary to make a philosophic presentation of justice, most of which I've left out in this early induction. I didn't discuss the traitor principle, how justice applies to economic or material issues, or the issue of the unearned in matter and spirit, how it applies to love, and so on and so on. And above all, how do you judge people morally, which we haven't even indicated yet, except in this is very simple common sense way, which would require us to understand why people need morality and something about the nature of man. And on top of that, if you read Ayn Rand, you'll realize that she defines justice as a subdivision of objectivity and holds that the crucial element of justice is judging men objectively. And of course, we haven't even dreamt of talking about objectivity. So justice is a very complicated, high-level issue, but the point is here we have made a start, a real start, and got it into existence. And then the rest is reaching other concepts and integrating them with justice, or reaching new applications that give us more and more understanding of what we have reached, constantly spiraling back to this and then going forward. But that's as much as we're going to do to start. Now, our last point in regard to every topic should be integration. And there's all kinds of integrations we could make between justice. What about this one? I just happened to notice justice is judging people. And that involves a process of thought. And it's very similar to the process that was involved in production in our second lecture. The process, remember, of thought and analysis. And it came up in egoism, because one of the things that entitled us to live for our own sake was that we have to achieve our own values by our own thought and work. So we have three different cases now in which one way or another reason plays a crucial role in regard to how we should act and how to gain our values. The first week it's the agent of producing them. The next week it's the thing that entitles us, at least in part, to our egoist motivation. This week it's the thing that helps us as to preserve the producers and strike down their enemies. Now, if we're philosophical, we're starting to see that reason pops up time and again, and one thing after another that's crucial to life or the enjoyment of life involves the process of thought. Now, you know where that's going to go, but you see where it's coming from. You're not yet prepared to say the basic virtue is rationality, but we're prepared to say, you know, there's a lot of places you wouldn't think, and yet thinking keeps coming up, and gee, that's the definition of man, and now, you know, at some point we're ready to go. Now, what about relating justice to egoism? Well, last time we... today we reached the inductions about justice by reference to what would promote or enhance the person's values. So we're concluding today that justice is a necessity of egoism. Now, last time we said that selfishness or egoism is based in part on justice because anything else would be unfair. So are we mixed up here, or have we hit a mother load? Which is the truth? I can just see someone asking this. Is it that selfishness is just, or is justice selfish? Now, if we had a show of hands, I'm sure half of you would say selfishness is just, and the other half would say justice is selfish. Well, maybe not. I can't be sure. But the fact is, it's both. And that is integration. To have a full validation of selfishness, you need justice, and a full validation of justice, you need selfishness. But you're going to say to me, well, something has to come first. Which comes first of these two? And my answer is, which hierarchy are you talking about? Are you talking about the final, what we're calling the OPAR presentation? Now, in that case, egoism definitely precedes justice. Because the structure is the fundamentals, life, reason, egoism, and then justice is a derivative. It's just a concrete under reason. But in the inductive pattern, in the OTI pattern, you have to start somewhere. And the fact is, you could start with egoism using a common sense of justice, and then reach justice, or you could start with justice using a common sense concept of I'm doing it for my own purposes, and then go on to validate that. You start in an early context with whatever you happen to know when you start your inductions. And what you're going to finally find is that each entails the other. Now, obviously, this integration process can go on as long as you have the strength. What about justice and causality? Well, justice is an implementation or example of causality. His action, the person you're judging, is the cause, and the reward or punishment is the effect. Now, you should start to see, you know, if you do this, you should be able to take, you know, I think, did I mention this course about the game? This is a game. One of the ways that Ayn Rand used to train us in integration, we would play a game. You'd put a whole bunch of different objectivist principles, each on a slip of paper in a hat. And then you'd pick up two at random, and you had to say what the connection to it. It was like a parlor game, but it was fun. And we even did it in rhyme sometimes, you know. But what you have to come to see, not necessarily with that game, is that the separate principles that we induce start to redound on each other, and eventually they cohere into a total, which is objectivism. And at that point, you'll hear somebody say, gee, you agree with Ayn Rand on everything. Don't you have any independence? Why not just accept egoism and throw out justice? Why follow slavishly everything? And you just throw up your hands in despair because it means they have no concept of philosophy and specifically of integration at all. That's in case you read U.S. News and World Report. Now, that's what I want to say about justice. Now, unfortunately, I have a lot of written questions. I say unfortunately because we only have 15 minutes for questions here, but let me try to rattle off some answers. Just out of curiosity to see how much time I have, I want to count to three. And at the end of three, I mean, you can unmute your mutes now if you have a question. Just say your first name loudly, and I'll see if there's any names or if I can pick up any names. Although I'm still going to do the written question first. One, two, three.
Steve.
Steve and Mark.
Steve and Mark? Okay, that's the most we're going to get to. So, Steve and Mark, you get ready. I'm going to try to squeeze you both in. You can remute now. I don't know how you heard those two words, because I just heard like a bark, that's all. But these are some questions I want to get to in writing. A couple on egoism, and that's fine. You can ask about earlier classes, if a question occurs to you. And they amount to, given our definition of egoism that we reached, various cases of who can be called an egoist by that definition. And for instance, this one is about a person who pursues bad values and claims it's for his own sake. Like he takes LSD because it makes him feel high, or him personally. Or he steals because he doesn't want to work. Or he enjoys vegetating by watching TV all day, and then therefore he doesn't have to exert any effort. Now, the common question is, these behaviors don't involve placing others or God or anything above yourself. So are they examples of egoism? Well, I wish we had time to take a poll and shoot you down, etc., but I have to just say no, they are not by our inductive definition. Thus, these types of policies cannot be subsumed under the kind of examples that we use to induce, because these are not goals that we chose and achieved by creative thought and action to promote life or the enjoyment of it, which was our criteria. They're the reverse. This is what you pursue to escape choice, escape thought, and escape action, and in the process undercut your life and happiness. They're self-destructive. So the person does not actually benefit from these actions. He merely feels that he he feels that he does, or he intends to benefit himself, let us say. He wants to be the beneficiary. But actually, he's the victim. He's his own victim. Now, there's a very important point here that that applies much more broadly than to egoism. But let's first state it as applied to egoism. It's the idea, this is what's wrong, that an action is egoistic if you are the actual or intended beneficiary, regardless of whether there's any basis for your intention. That's completely illegitimate to define egoism as I am the actual or intended beneficiary, even if there's no basis for my intention. It's completely arbitrary or flies in the face of the evidence available. Ethics is concerned with what you do and what it actually results in, not with intentions divorced from reality. Arbitrary intentions do not belong under any valid ethical concept, including egoism, because that would make the concept detached from reality. Now, here would be an example in connection with justice. Is this just? The juror in a given case intends to be fair, but he ignores reality and goes by his feelings, but he feels sincerely that he wants to be fair. Now, would you say, well, this is a just man, his intention is to be fair? Of course, his intention has no basis in reality, whatever. You'd say, certainly not. This is a man who simply throws out justice. And the same is true if he, quote, intends to be selfish, only in the process he harms himself and denies everything that would be a benefit to him. Now, I think the best way to describe the cases in the egoism situation is to say that in those cases, there's no actual beneficiary. In fact, the actor is harming himself or destroying himself. So we need three different classifications to cover the empirical data. Selfish actions, unselfish or selfless actions undertaken to benefit God or others or whatever, and plain self-destructive actions with no beneficiary at all. So I do not call the criminals, etc., egoists or altruists. Now, you must realize here that I am not thereby excommunicating a person who chooses a wrong value through an honest error of knowledge. You can make a mistake and still be 100% entitled to egoism even if your mistake harms you. Take Reardon, for instance. He is an egoist throughout the book, even in his pursuit of mistaken values, such as his concern for his marriage contract with Lillian or for Philip's well-being. He didn't see that he was in a contradiction or that he was actually harming himself. Egoism is a moral designation. And no honest error can disqualify you from belonging under a moral principle. You are not an unjust person just because you reach a mistaken verdict. You are not an unproductive person morally if you are blocked for years and don't turn out anything, but you're doing the best you can. You are not non-objective if you commit a logical fallacy. And the same is true with egoism. All moral principles have in them, within your best honest understanding, I am acting to achieve, etc. And that's how I would answer that question. Now, an allied question on egoism, is it wrong to classify Epicurus or Nietzsche or traditional philosophers of that sort as egoists, since they certainly don't subscribe to the concept of choosing and acting creatively to achieve the values that lead to your own life and happiness. And I would say it's okay to call them egoists if you realize you're doing that classification or using that term as a historian of philosophy, intent only on distinguishing one philosopher from another. It is not of any use or application in life. In other words, if your context is you're a historian of ideas, then it may be helpful to say, I'm going to ignore completely everything about this philosopher's values and look only at whether or not he thinks you should act to gain something for yourself. Now, you can't possibly validate egoism that way, but that's not what you as a historian are doing. You're just saying, well, I want to collect Epicurus, Nietzsche, and Ayn Rand on one side as against Augustine, Kant, and Dewey on the other. And that can have a limited value in making a certain kind of distinction. But those definitions are not relevant to the way to live your life. And if I, as an objectivist versus a neutral historian, were asked to describe Nietzsche and Epicurus in this issue, I would say they are would-be egoists who have no idea how to be egoists. And therefore, both of them end up preaching the opposite of egoism in substance, even though that's not their intention. All right, let's take Steve. Unmute and fire away, Steve, wherever you are.
Thank you. The example you drew, one of the examples that you mentioned when you were discussing the difference between how one might respond to a machine or a rat as opposed to how one responds to a man doing something good or bad was moral emotions. reverence, hero worship, condemnation, etc. Now, this question may be too tangential, but I'd be grateful if you'd comment on the nature of moral emotions as such. I tend to think of emotions as rather primitive responses to automatic values.
No, that is incorrect. Let me correct that. An emotion is not a primitive response to an automatic value. Not at all. A response to an automatic value would be one that's physiologically built into you. And that wouldn't even be an emotion, that's a sensation. An emotion is always a response to a chosen value. And in that sense, it's so far from being primitive, it's a reflection of a higher mentality. It involves a knowledge of what a certain thing is in some terms, and then an evaluation of it. By a moral emotion, I mean simply a response to a moral evaluation. Not all evaluations are moral evaluations. You can say how pretty somebody is, how great they are as an athlete, how efficiently they do something, and how much you admire that. There's a lot of different levels on which you can evaluate and thereby respond positively or negatively. A moral evaluation is specifically when you invoke a moral code, or what's the equivalent of that in your mind, to judge. And a moral code is, in essence, a fundamental evaluation chosen by a person that governs the sum of their behavior. That's not simply specialize into aesthetics, athletics, etc. That's all I mean by a moral emotion. Now, I want to try to take up, in the little time we have, some of these written questions, except somebody asked me to induce the principle that all knowledge is contextual. And I have to put that off till the next course, because there's a whole lecture on that. But here's a question, of which the substance of it is, you don't talk about the unit perspective. Does the unit perspective have a role in the forming of an induction? If yes, what is it? Yes, of course. A unit is a member of a group of similars. It's viewing something as a member of a group of two or more similars. And that is inherently a relational perspective on something, where you say, it belongs with these others as against that. That is the essence of concept formation. Viewing an object not simply as a thing, but as like these things versus those things over there. Every time you use a concept, you are using the unit perspective. And the same is true when you combine concepts into propositions, whether you reach them by induction or deduction. You are thinking of something as a unit, as one of many, as against something different. And that's where the genus comes in. Now, for instance, suppose I take the inductive principle, all tables are expensive, a very simple principle. Let's suppose my genus would be a need of man. Or what is required to get a need of man. And under one would be the thing is expensive, and under two, under the other side would be the thing is free, like air. Now, my principle that tables are expensive takes every single table and relates them as members of this one same category, expensive, as against all the things outside of it, like air and sunlight and whatever. So I'm looking at all tables as units now within the category of expensive. And there's a lot of other things in there that are also instances of being expensive. So you could never have a proposition without the unit perspective any more than you could have a concept without it. Now I want to answer half of a written question, and I'll try to get to the other half next time. Because it's too long and we only have 2 minutes. You said that ancient Greece, and also this question came in today. If you want your question answered on a given day, you got to give me at least 48 hours. I can't get a question handed to me just before I go on. So if it doesn't come in by Wednesday morning, it's not going to get in except for this one half of this question. You said that ancient Greece and America... Oh, wait a minute. I have Mark, too. Mark, are you there? Mark? What happened to him? Hello? Unmute. Oh, there was no Mark. Okay, well, that worked out fine because there is no time. You mentioned that ancient Greece and America were the only egoistic societies. Doesn't slavery in Greece and in the South in America detract from that? Well, it detracts from their consistency, except that in both these places, slavery was a matter of anthropology, not of ethics, and we're classifying them ethically. In other words, the Greeks did not think that the slaves were fully human. They were from barbarian cultures, and to them there were the full humans, and then there were the savages that they didn't think were fully human. Aristotle went so far as to say they had a different category of intelligence. And the same in America, did not think that blacks were full humans. Now, this is profoundly mistaken beliefs, but they were not a violation of an ethical principle. They were a failure to grasp what belongs under egoism. Of course, in America, when they did discover that, they abolished slavery. So I do not think that slavery detracts from the correctness of the practice, but it doesn't detract from the fact that egoism is the proper description of them morally within the context of their knowledge. And then you ask, what about Italy during the Renaissance? I guess you would say yes about that. I'm not too clear about the politics and philosophy during the Renaissance. I know that the Renaissance was still deeply religious compared to the 18th century, compared to the Enlightenment. Although it was less religious than the medieval period, and I've never made enough of a study to know, but the question would be, how secular was the soul of Italy during the Renaissance? Was it still essentially God-oriented or not? Now, I don't know enough to know, but that would be what... Steve Jolivet, are you there? No, I guess he's not here tonight.
Yeah.
In a word, yes or no, was Italy secular enough in the Renaissance to qualify as egoistic?
It was secular. Egoistic, not quite.
Because? Why not?
It was just not well enough developed in their politics.
That's what I tend to think, that the Renaissance is a transitional period. They just like escaped from the concentration camp, and you couldn't use it to define clearly a moral principle because they were reeling under the old and just groping for the new. That's why I stayed away from it. But I'm sure you could find nice people in Italy during the Renaissance, as far as that goes. Now, the other half of the question from this same person will have to wait until next time. So now draw a line, and we are going to go to objectivity and see what we can get done in half an hour here. So I'm pausing for 10 seconds. He paused for 10 seconds to celebrate the Titanic during the Academy Awards. So I'm giving you the equivalent to change your focus from justice to objectivity. Now, this is our first venture into epistemology. I left it until now. We're halfway through about now, right? Because this is more complicated than induction in either metaphysics or ethics. But I think you have enough of a groundwork now to face it. My hope is that this will give you a broader perspective on induction by illustrating it on a different branch of philosophy, of course, epistemology. And also, since it's a crucial issue, we're going to be exploring it in later classes. Now, by doing this branch, something from epistemology, comparatively later in the course, we're thereby mirroring the history of the human race and of a growing child. Epistemology is inherently a late development. It presupposes an enormous amount of accumulated knowledge in a variety of fields, attained by a number of different cognitive processes. Only at that point can you look inward, abstract away from the different contents, and grasp your methods of cognition as such. This is one reason why epistemology was not even approached by civilizations before Greece. There was simply not enough reliable knowledge to even raise the question of where does reliable knowledge come from. But by the time of Socrates and Plato, which is basically when epistemology starts, there had been enough developments in astronomy, mathematics, medicine, a few other fields, so that it was possible to start asking epistemological questions. Now, since epistemology presupposes that we've already performed the processes of gaining knowledge many times, even though we haven't yet identified those processes, philosophers had something to go on in identifying these processes. In other words, if you or others had never been objective, you could never hope to reach objectivity by induction. But the fact is that many human beings were and had to be implicitly objective in order to gain knowledge, even though they couldn't yet conceive the concept objectivity. And therefore, when people reached the point of stepping back to grasp the method, they already had countless examples available to them. And this is exactly parallel to, there has to have been a lot of people who are rational before you can identify such a concept. And the same for logical, moral, just, etc. And you can be these things on a certain level before you can identify or conceptualize them. Now, you can't be them by conscious, deliberate choice, but you can grasp the substance, you can be the substance of them. Now, objectivity, that is the central concept of objectivism, as the very name indicates. As I put it in Opar, Ayn Rand was the first to define this essential cognitive norm fully. Now, it's going to take us a long time to get to Ayn Rand in this course, if we do get to it in terms of objectivity. But we're going to start, as I said, by trying to reach the pre-Ayn Rand concept of objectivity. Objectivity as understood by the best people before her, and that means, above all, Aristotle, who was the first to reach the concept. Now, this early concept, even though incomplete, was enough to make possible modern science, the United States, and the Industrial Revolution. So there's no use brushing it aside to say, well, it's still, got gaps. It's obviously worth reconstructing Aristotle's development, his inductive development of objectivity. And also, crucially, Aristotle is the base whose discoveries in epistemology made possible Ayn Rand's unique concept. And after we get through Aristotle, we'll see how long it will take, and then we're going to do, either in full or in sketchy form, the inductive steps between Aristotle and Ayn Rand to reach her final concept. So your next homework, or whether we get to it next time and how much of it we actually do in class, is open still, is try to figure out, once you understand Aristotle's approach, What kind of induction? See if you can think of a couple of inductions that might be helpful in getting from Aristotle to Ayn Rand. I'm not going to tell you to reconstruct the whole of Ayn Rand's because it's too difficult. Now, I already gave you Aristotle's definition of objectivity, at least my words for his definition, and that is volitional adherence to reality by the use of logic. And our assignment is to show, using induction, why this is important to knowledge. Now I looked up, just for the heck of it, induction in the dictionary. And it amounts to the same idea, but not nearly as well stated. This is what the dictionary gives, and I think this is a fair objective, not affected by personal feelings, semicolon, based on facts. Now that, I guess, is pretty much the way the ordinary person understands it. It's based on facts, not on feelings. You set aside your feelings in being objective, and that seems to be the main thing that people grasp about objectivity that's included in the dictionary. Now, let's see what that would involve to reach that. Because if you said to an ancient Egyptian, set aside your feelings, yeah, he'd say, okay, now I don't feel anything. What happens now? Obviously, you can't set aside your feelings in a cognitive situation unless you have some idea of another way of grasping facts. And notice that based on fact in this definition can't be the same as learned by percepts. Because if fact based on fact meant learned perceptually, then all distinctively human knowledge would be excluded from objectivity. Therefore, what the dictionary definition tells us is we need to discover a kind of functioning, a kind of thought that leads us to fact rather than just our feelings. We need a way or kind or method of thinking tied to facts, tied to reality. And that comes back to a method of adhering to reality in regard to cognition. Now, this definition does not know of the connection between logic and objectivity. That's something Aristotle knew, but it didn't survive into the dictionary. So let's start with just this, the idea of a method of adhering to reality in gaining knowledge. And then later we'll discuss what the method is. But the first thing we have to ask is, how would you ever reach such an idea? The idea that we need a method at all. Now that's the first thing to say in the process of reducing. There's no use even discussing what the method would be before we get to how would we ever come to discover, how would that ancient Egyptian come to discover, and I doubt that he could, why you even need or want such a thing as a method of adhering to reality. In other words, why do we need to do anything special to adhere to reality? What is the value of having any rules of guidance or method? And then we'll find out why the specific guidance we need is logic. So you put yourself back to the beginning of mankind's epistemological development. How would you discover that you need rules or special guidance? Why would you ever think of looking for such a guide? Now I'll tell you right away what the answer is not. Because some people will think, well, this is pretty easy. We can easily discover by observation and induction that man is fallible, that he's capable of error. That's a snap. And it is a snap to find that out. Therefore, we can deduce, can't we, that you can't necessarily trust your conclusions just because they occur to you. Doesn't that follow from the fact that you're capable of error. Therefore, we can deduce, can't we, that you need some special method to guide you. Oh, nothing could be simpler, neater, or more rationalistic than that argument. It's perfect in every way, except that that is not the way it worked, nor could it have worked that way. So if you incline to grab a fact and then make deductions from it, this is a perfect example of a dead end that you would reach. Now, of course, it's necessary to grasp our capacity for error if we are ever to reach the concept of objectivity. But the two things are way far apart from each other. The grasp of fallibility is extremely easy. It goes back into prehistory. Basically, it goes back to the early days when a caveman's wife hit him over the head angrily because he brought home the wrong beer. So it's no news to her that you can make mistakes. That has been known from time immemorial. But the interesting fact that the rationalistic deduction completely overlooks is that this knowledge that we're capable of error never suggested to anyone before the Greeks the idea of objectivity, of the need of a method to check out our conclusions and guide our mental processes. Now, is that a paradox? No, because you're taking as self-evident what was a monumental discovery by the Greeks, and specifically by Aristotle. The pre-Greeks had their own solution to the problem of error. And it wasn't objectivity, but a version of intrinsicism, which to them was self-evident. In other words, authority and faith in authority. If you said to the Egyptian, well, how do you know? The Pharaoh knows all. God knows. And then other civilizations, the tribal chief just knows. Error, they would say, or at least crucial error, comes from arrogance. So what you have to do in the face of fallibility is fall on your knees and submit. That was the actual conclusion drawn from error for thousands and thousands of years. So you're taking a completely unwarranted leap if you think you can go straight from, well, we're fallible, therefore we need objectivity or logic or some kind of reality-based rules. And here, therefore, is a reduction for you. Before you can even think about guides in regard to how we should use our mind, you can easily see, before you can think about guides as to how we should use our mind, we have to know something about the mind, something about human consciousness. Something about how it does operate, what its different options or possibilities are, where and how it goes wrong when it does. If we don't have any clue how it goes wrong, or where it goes wrong, or what it could be doing differently from what it's doing, if it's just all taken for granted the way a child takes its mind for granted or an animal does, you can't possibly say, oh, now I'm going to figure out a way of using it better. You don't even know what you're doing with it. You can't even think of the idea of improving that which you don't even know is happening. And equally crucial, I'm still in the process of reduction, and I'll sort it out and give you an organized statement later. You have to know in what areas or uses your mind is safe or infallible. You have to know that first before you can start looking for a method, because only that knowledge will give you a clue as to what to do about error. Now, to explain this particular reduction to you. the only way we could ever guide our minds reliably without reference to authority would be to discover that something in our mind, some part of our knowledge, is inherently error-free. And then we could figure out later how to use the safe data to help us test the fallible data. And that's exactly what objectivity really consists of. When we say you have to reduce all conceptual products to sensory observation, but if no content of human consciousness were self-evident and 100% trustworthy, we could never devise a method of guiding ourselves to the truth. We would have nothing to count on in any conclusion, including the conclusion about how to improve our mental processes. So we would be stopped dead. So we have to discover certain important distinctions among the contents of our consciousness before you can even get to the question, what method would improve it? You have to have engaged in a basic study of what is human consciousness before it can even occur to you that you can do something on your own about your errors, and before you can have even a clue as to what to do. So now the question is, what do we have to know about human consciousness to reach the point of realizing it's up to us to do something to keep it on the track? How can anyone discover an aspect of consciousness that can go wrong as against an aspect which is safe or reliable? Because this is a crucially necessary step. Now, we know that we have free will and are in charge of something that goes on in our consciousness, because there would be no possibility of even thinking about how to guide it if it's entirely out of our control. So, what we're coming down to with our reduction is that Aristotle is going to have to make a crucial discovery. There's a part of our mind that can go wrong, and that is the part where we are in control, where we have free will or choice. Versus there's a part where we are safe, where we don't need control. And we are then able to make the decision to check one part via the other. This is, in essence, what you had to be known before you could look for a method of guidance. Now, going on with the reduction, what obvious major discovery about consciousness has to be made in order then later to discover one part is infallible, one is not, one we have control over, one we don't? What is the basic distinction in the content of consciousness that had to be discovered to make these later distinctions and thereby to grasp the need of a method? Obviously, you have to grasp the distinction in some form between percepts and concepts. Now, you don't need those words. Plato and Aristotle called it the realm of sense and the realm of ideas. Ideas, the Greek word, is actually the original Greek word. Ideas, they call them, or forms, or universals, or essences. The terminology doesn't matter. But until you make the distinction between two basically different kinds of mental content, you are nowhere in the issue of prescribing guidance. Before that distinction, all you can know is, sometimes I seem to be in control of my mental content, and sometimes not. Sometimes my content proves wrong, and sometimes it's obviously right. But you would have no clue as to why these differences, and no clue as to what to do about it. And therefore, you would be completely debarred from raising such a question as, now let me figure out a method, you know, of remaining on track. So let us put this in a structured way now. In order to reach the conclusion, which is the going to be the first big conclusion on the way to objectivity, that man needs a method of adhering to reality or of avoiding error. That's going to be our first big conclusion. And then after we get that, we'll figure out what the method is. But let's just break it up, objectivity, into this as the first big conclusion. That in itself, and I'm just going over the reduction, you couldn't reach the method until you discovered that a method was necessary and possible. It's not enough to say we're capable of error. And what that would be the first on the way down in reduction and the last on the way up in induction. And what does that require? I'm just restating now in a more structured way. What does that require to grasp that a method is necessary and impossible? Well, I think it requires basically three things. And I'm not sure that there is an order. I think these three things may be optional in what exact order you do them. So I'm just listing them as A, B, and C. And then if I or someone can prove to me that one of these has to come before the other, I can't do it. But to me, there are three things you have to grasp that a method is necessary and possible. One is, what kinds of error are possible? And that means basically you have to discover what kind of mental content is fallible versus infallible. And this is, I think, is indispensable for arriving one day at the idea of a method, because then you have an idea what you're trying to correct and that you're trying to do it by somehow measuring one against the other. But until you have the distinction between the two, you're nowhere. Another thing, obviously, you have to discover is that you have control over the fallible area. That free will extends to the fallible area. Otherwise, you can't possibly say this is what you should be doing if you have no control. And a third thing you would have to know is what is the relationship between these two areas. In what way could you somehow relate or measure or reduce the fallible to the infallible? You get that? You'd have to establish that. And once you had established, there are these two areas, and the problem of error comes in the fallible area, that's the one I have control of, and the what you can do with that because of its nature is check it out by the infallible area, then you're all ready to say, God, we need a method, and it's possible. I get an idea. The method would be figuring out, you know, how to apply this. So that's our A, B, and C to lead us to the necessary impossibility of a method. And then the question becomes, and what does all that depend on? No one could think in such abstract terms except going backwards. But going forwards, you couldn't start by, well, I have to find a fallible and an infallible and so on. What do you have to grasp directly in order then to grasp all these attributes, which is correct and which is capable of error and which we have choice and which reduces to which? You have to grasp the distinction between the conceptual and the perceptual. That is the direct observable here. So if you go in order of induction, now our first induction is to grasp the distinction between concepts and percepts. Then, by a variety of inductions, we have to grasp that concepts are capable of error, percepts are not. That we have control over concepts, or over the functioning of the concepts, but not over percepts. And that somehow we can use percepts as a means to measure concepts. And then we're ready to say, a method is necessary, because we know that we've got to correct our errors, and it's possible because we know in essence what it would be. By the proper use of our minds, which we're in charge of, we can reduce the error part to the non-error part, and thereby check it out. Now that, let me see if we have anything. I don't think it's worth repeating this over again. I wrote it out in other language, but that's pretty clear. Let me just, instead of repeating it, I'll take a moment now, and you can unmute and call out your name if something is unclear up to this point. You don't have to be intimidated. Oh, I have to count 1, 2, 3. Sorry. 1, 2, 3.
Peter,
go ahead.
I don't understand the difference between concept formation and induction.
Well, those are radically different. I mean, they're not opposite, but a concept, think of as a single word. Like table, chair, man, star, run, hit, red, green, etc. A concept is like a file folder in which you designate a certain category, all the things that have this shape, for instance, table, or this structure, which is man. And then you put in that file folder every piece of information you gather by studying a few men, and you say, since it belongs to this category, what I have learned about the few men, that they're mortal, for instance, applies to all the rest in this category. So induction is, let's say, the cash value of concept formation. Concept formation, you form the single word, which is the file folder. Induction, you formulate a proposition, a sentence, a statement, all so-and-so is so-and-so, which consists of applying to every member in the category the things that you learn by studying some of them. Does that answer you? Hello? You have to say yes or no.
I'll have to think about it. Thanks.
Well, I can't do much with that. Okay, you think about that. Man is a concept. All men are mortal is four concepts united into a proposition which is reached by induction. Does that help?
Is induction used in concept formation?
No, that's a great question. Induction is not used in the forming of a concept. The forming of a concept, just for instance, is here's one table and another table and another, and I'm going to set these aside as against chair. And I'm going to use this as a category from now on and call it table. There's no generalization in that. There's simply the setting aside of some concretes and opening the file. But now the first time you start studying tables and you find, for instance, they're made of wood, assume that was true. You do that by studying 10 of them, and then you say, okay, that goes into the file now. All tables are wooden. That is an induction. Does that answer you?
Yes, thank you.
Well, you know, it's a good thing that you didn't ask that last week, because in my more advanced seminar, that was exactly the topic we talked about in the very last meeting. Is induction used to form a concept? So that's hot off the griddle. Now, we had 4 minutes, and we get 4 minutes, so if I have 8, take away 3, we have 5 minutes, right?
Leonard?
Yes.
It's Harry.
Yes.
Did you mean to discuss this week or next week more about what's involved in your point C about the relation Aristotle grasped between concepts and percepts?
Oh, I haven't even come to that yet. All I wanted to say here is that we're going to have to deal with that topic on the way to objectivity.
Okay.
But I haven't given any idea even what the distinction is and how you would grasp it, let alone the relation of the two. We got to do the inductions now. All we've done is order them. You see what I mean? Is that clear?
Okay.
Well,
Leonard.
Okay, I may as well not try to start. Go ahead. Yes.
It's Gary.
Yes, Gary.
Do you know when the first time the concept of objectivity was used?
The word?
Yeah, the actual concept was first discovered.
I assume it's medieval. I don't know.
Okay.
Because it sounds like it's a medieval term that comes from the Latin, I think. It's from yakio to throw, I would think. But I'm just making that up out of my head. I don't think the Greeks had any such term. Now, I'm not sure, but we're talking about the substance of their idea.
Right.
Well, we got 1 or 2 minutes now, so it's too late for me to... Hey, what about the other half of that question?
You put it down there.
Yeah. So now I got the very last question. Now, so you can drop this here and go on to whatever homework you can... whatever you can do now to do these inductions. You can think about them now that I've structured them. And whatever steps you can think would come after logic, and that'll certainly occupy us for next time. Now, let me try to take a quick hit and run in the last 2 or 3 minutes. The idea of this question is, you discussed only the pure cases of egoism and altruism. Is it possible to induce why a mixed union of egoism and altruism is wrong? In other words, the way it stands in most people's minds when it's not pure. And then the example is given, I'm mostly egoistic, but occasionally go to extended family events, including religious weddings, although I don't really care about those people. Well, you have to decide in yourself, is that an example of altruism or not? Are you actually sacrificing? Because sacrifice is not synonymous with doing what you don't enjoy doing. If you think, you know, you're not spending much time on it and it would mean something to people that matter to you and it doesn't involve compromising your principles. An atheist does not compromise his principles by going to a religious wedding. On the other hand, if it truly is a sacrifice, in other words, given your values and principles and your hierarchy, you are giving up something that is objectively important to you or something that you regard as the true or the moral, to do something immoral and to lose something valuable, then you are definitely a mixed case. And then, so you ask me, how do I induce what's wrong with a mixed case? And there's really only 2 answers to that in principle. I can't go through it, obviously, in 1 minute, but the 2 answers are, it would have nothing to do with egoism and altruism concretely. You would be trying to act in an unprincipled fashion, is one. And that means you would be having to act on emotion. Since you don't act on the principle of egoism or the principle of altruism, what is governing which you do when? And it's obviously your desire, your feeling, what social pressures you think you have to give into and which you don't. So it comes down to, can I induce why emotionalism, unprincipled whim-worshipping, is undesirable? Yes, I definitely can, although I'm not going to do it now. The other thing is to show that in any compromise between 2 principles, a good and an evil, the evil wins and brings all its destructive power down. And why, if you start by sacrificing even to the extent of once a year for your family, but it's a true sacrifice, and you feel they're entitled to it, but you're going to combine it with egoism, you're going to end up exactly the way the United States ended up, as a mixed case, and compromise, the little bit of poison, ended up corrupting all the food. So it would take those 2 inductions separately and then applied to show why a mixed philosophy is wrong, if the fact that it's contradictory is not in itself sufficient. I hope that's enough of an answer, and I believe that is exactly to the second. So next week, we'll be completely on objectivity, Until then, good night, good morning, goodbye.